Turner shuttled the video back and pressed the play button. Watch carefully. The recorder rotates the five cameras and films 5 seconds of each.
So the longest gap between cameras is 20 seconds?
Got it. You watching? OK, there's the manuscript. She pointed at the book, clearly visible in the frame as the VCR flicked to the camera at the front door. There was no movement. Then, the inside door through which any burglar would have to come. All the other entrances were barred. Then came the corridor, then the lobby, then the machine flicked back to the manuscript room. Turner punched the pause button, and I leaned closer. The manuscript was gone.
20 seconds to get in, open the box, take Chuzzlewit, and then leg it. It's not possible.
Believe you me, Thursday, it happened.
The last remark came from Boswell, who had been looking over my shoulder.
I don't know how they did it, but they did. I've had a call from Supreme Commander Gale on this one, and he's been leaned on by the Prime Minister. Questions have already been asked in the House, and someone's head is going to roll. Not mine, I assure you.
He looked at us both rather pointedly, which made me feel especially ill at ease. I was the one who had advised the museum on its security arrangements.
We'll be on to it straight away, sir, I replied, punching the pause button and letting the video run on.
The views of the building changed rhythmically, revealing nothing. I pulled up a chair, rewound the tape, and looked again.
What are you hoping to find?
Asked Paige.
Anything.
I didn't find it. Chapter 3. Back at my desk. Funding for the Special Operations Network comes directly from the government. Most work is centralised, but all of the Spec Ops divisions have local representatives to keep a watchful eye on any provincial problems. They are administered by local commanders who liaise with the national offices for information exchange, guidance and policy decisions. Like any other big government department, it looks good on paper, but is an utter shambles. Petty infighting and political agendas, arrogance and sheer bloody-mindedness almost guarantees that the left hand doesn't know what the right is doing. Milon de Flos, A Short History of the Special Operations Network. 2 days of fruitless hunting for Chuzzlewit had passed without even the slightest clue as to where it might be. There had been whispers of reprimands, but only if we could figure out how the manuscript was taken. It would seem a bit ludicrous to be chastised for leaving a loophole in the security arrangements, but not know what it was. Now, slightly despondent, I was sitting at my desk back at the station. Recalling my conversation with Dad, I phoned my mother to ask her not to paint the bedroom mauve. The call backfired slightly, as she thought this a grand idea, and hung up before I could argue. I sighed, and flipped through the telephone messages that had accumulated over the past 2 days. They were mostly from informers and concerned citizens who had been robbed or cheated and wanted to know if we had made any headway. It was all small beer compared to Chuzzlewit. There were a lot of gullible people out there buying first editions of Byronic verse at knockdown prices, then complaining bitterly when they found out they were fakes. Like most of the other operatives, I had a pretty good idea who was behind all of this, but we never caught the big fish, just the utterers, the dealers who sold it all on. It smacked of corruption in high places, but we never had any proof. Usually I read my messages with interest, but today none of it seemed terribly important. After all, the verses of Byron, Keats or Poe are real whether they are in bootleg form or not. You can still read them for the same effect. I opened the drawer of my desk and pulled out a small mirror. A woman with somewhat ordinary features stared back at me. Her hair was a plain mousy colour and of medium length, tied up rather hastily in a ponytail at the back. She had no cheekbones to speak of, and her face, I noticed, had just started to show some rather obvious lines. I thought of my mother, who had looked as wrinkled as a walnut by the time she was 45. I shuddered, placed the mirror back in the drawer, and took out a faded and slightly dog-eared photograph.
It was a photo of myself with a group of friends taken in the Crimea when I had been simply Corporal T.E. Next 3355-0336, Driver APC, Light Armoured Brigade. I had served my country diligently, been involved in a military disaster, and then honourably discharged with a gong to prove it. They had expected me to give talks about recruitment and valour, but I had disappointed them. I attended one regimental reunion, but that was it. I had found myself looking for the faces that I knew weren't there. In the photo, Landon was standing on my left, his arm around me, and another soldier, my brother, his best mate. Landon lost a leg, but he came home. My brother was still out there.
"Who's that?" asked Paige, who had been looking over my shoulder.
"What?" I yelped. "You just scared the crap out of me."
"Sorry. Crimea?" I handed her the photo, and she looked at it intently. "That must be your brother. You have the same nose."
"I know. We used to share it on a rota. I had it Mondays, Wednesday."
"Then the other man must be Landon."
I frowned and turned to face her. I never mentioned Landon to anyone. It was personal. I felt kind of betrayed that she might have been prying behind my back.
"How do you know about Landon?"
She sensed the anger in my voice, smiled, and raised an eyebrow.
"You told me about him."
"I did."
"Sure. The speech was slurred, and for the most part it was garbage, but he was certainly on your mind."
I winced. "Last year's Christmas bash."
"Nor the year before. You weren't the only one talking garbage with slurred speech."
I looked at the photo again. "We were engaged." Paige suddenly looked uneasy. Crimean fiancés could be seriously bad conversation topics.
"Did he, come back?"
"Most of him. He left a leg behind. We don't speak too much these days."
"What's his full name?" asked Paige, interested in finally getting something out of my past.
"It's Park Lane. Landon Park Lane." It was the first time I had said his name out loud for almost longer than I could remember.
"Park Lane the writer?"
I nodded.
"Good-looking bloke."
"Thank you," I replied, not quite knowing what I was thanking her for. I put the photograph back in my drawer, and Paige clicked her fingers.
"Boswell wants to see you," she announced,
finally remembering what she had come over to say. Boswell was not alone. A man in his 40s was waiting for me, and rose as I entered. He didn't blink very much, and had a large scar down one side of his face. Boswell hummed and hawed for a moment, coughed, looked at his watch, and then said something about leaving us to it.
"Police?" I asked as soon as we were alone. "Has a relative died or something?"
The man closed the Venetian blinds to give us more privacy.
"Not that I heard about."
"SO1? I asked, expecting a possible reprimand.
"Me?"
replied the man with genuine surprise.
"No."
"Literatech?"
"Why don't you sit down?"
He offered me a seat, and then sat down in Boswell's large oak swivel chair. He had a buff file with my name on the cover, which he flopped on the desk in front of him. I was amazed by how thick the file was.
"Is that all about me?"
He ignored me. Instead of opening my file, he leaned forward and gazed at me with his unblinking eyes.
"How do you rate the Chuzzlewit case?"
I found myself staring at his scar. It ran from his forehead down to his chin, and had all the size and subtlety of a shipbuilder's weld. It pulled his lip up, but apart from that, his face was pleasant enough. Without the scar, he might have been handsome. I was being unsubtle. He instinctively brought up a hand to cover it.
"Finest Cossack,"
he murmured, making light of it. "I'm sorry."
"Don't be. It's hard not to gawp."
He paused for a moment.
"I work for Spec Ops 5," he announced slowly, showing me a shiny badge.
"SO5?" I gasped, failing to hide the surprise in my voice. "What do you lot do?"
"That's restricted, Miss Next. I showed you the badge so you could talk to me without worrying about security clearances. I can okay that with Boswell if you'd prefer."
My heart was beating faster. Interviews with Spec Ops operatives farther up the ladder sometimes led to transfers.
"So, Miss Next, what do you think about Chuzzlewit?"
"You want my opinion or the official version?"
"Your opinion. Official versions I get from Boswell."
"I think it's too early to tell. If ransom is the motive, then we can assume the manuscript is still in one piece. If it's stolen, to sell or barter, we can also consider it in one piece. If terrorism is the game, then we might have to be worried. In scenarios 1 and 3, the Literatex have sod all to do with it. SO9 get involved, and we're kind of out of the picture." The man looked at me intently and nodded his head.
"You don't like it here, do you?"
"I've had enough, put it that way," I responded, slightly less guardedly than I should. "Who are you, anyway?" The man laughed.
"Sorry, very bad manners. I didn't mean all the cloak and dagger stuff. The name's Tamworth, head field operative at SO5. Actually," he added, "that doesn't mean so much. At present, there are just me and 2 others.
I shook his outstretched hand. "3 people in a Spec Ops division?" I asked curiously. "Isn't that kind of mean?"
"I lost some guys yesterday."
"I'm sorry."
"Not that way. We just made a bit of headway, and that's not always good news. Some people research well in SO5, but don't like the field work. They have kids, I don't. But I understand."
I nodded. I understood too. "Why are you talking to me?" I asked almost casually. "I'm SO27. As the Spec Ops Transfer Board so kindly keep telling me, my talents lie either in front of a Literatech desk or a kitchen stove." Tamworth smiled. He patted the file in front of him.
"I know all about that. Spec Ops Central Recruiting don't really have a good word for no, they just fob. It's what they're best at. On the contrary, they are fully aware of your potential. I spoke to Boswell just now, and he thinks he can just about let you go if you want to help us over at SO5.
"If you're SO5, he doesn't have much choice, does he?" Tamworth laughed.
"That's true, but you do. I'd never recruit anyone who didn't want to join me."
I looked at him. He meant it. "Is this a transfer?"
"No," replied Tamworth. "It isn't. I just need you because you have information that is of use to us. You'll be an observer, nothing more. Once you understand what we're up against, you'll be very glad to be just that."
"So, when this is over, I just get thrown back here?" He paused and looked at me for a moment, trying to give the best assurance that he could without lying. I liked him for it.
"I make no guarantees, Miss Next, but anyone who has been on an SO5 assignment can be pretty confident that they won't be SO27 forever."
"What is it you want me to do?" Tamworth pulled a form from his case and pushed it across the table to me. It was a standard security clearance, and once signed, gave Spec Ops the right to almost everything I possessed, and a lot more besides if I so much as breathed a word to someone with a lesser clearance. I signed it dutifully and handed it back. In exchange, he gave me a shiny SO5 badge with my name already in place. Tamworth knew me better than I thought. This done, he lowered his voice and began.
SO5 is basically a search and containment facility. We are posted with a man to track until found and contained. Then we get another. SO4 is pretty much the same. They are just after a different thing. Person, you know. Anyway, I was down at Gad's Hill this morning, Thursday,